by which time he, Aria, Angela, and the Weercat had exited the cathedral and were running down the front steps. Without pausing to give Sephira an opportunity to make sense of his jumbled recollections, Aragorn said, "We need a distraction, now!" She acknowledged his statement, and he could feel her tip into a steep dive. "Also, tell Nasawada to start her attack. We'll be at the south gate in a few minutes. If the Varden aren't there when we open it, I don't know how we're going to escape." Black Shrike Thorn Cave. The cool, moist, morning air off water whistled past Sephira's head as she dove toward the rat nest city, half lit by the rising sun. The low rays of light made the smelly wood eggshell buildings stand out in high relief, their western sides black with shadow. The wolf elf in Aragorn's shape, who was riding on her back, shouted something at her, but the hungry wind tore at his words, and she could not make out his meaning. He began to ask her questions with his song-filled mind, but she did not wait to let him finish. Instead, she told him of Aragorn's plight and asked him to alert Nasawada that now was the time for action. How the shadow of Aragorn that Blodgarm wore was supposed to fool anyone, Sephira could not understand. He did not smell like her partner of heart and mind, nor did his thoughts feel like Aragorn's. Still, the two legs seemed impressed by the apparition, and it was the two legs they were trying to fool. On the left side of the rat nest city, the glittering shape of Thorn lay stretched out along the battlements above the southern gate. He lifted his crimson head, and she could tell that he had spotted her, hurtling toward the breakbone ground, as she had expected. Her feelings toward Thorn were too complicated to sum up in a few brief impressions. Every time she thought of him, she became confused and uncertain, something she was unaccustomed to. Nevertheless, she was not about to let the upstart whelp best her in battle. As the dark chimneys and sharp-edged roofs grew larger, she spread her wings a bit more, feeling the increased strain in her chest, shoulders, and wing muscles as she began to slow their descent. When she was only a few hundred feet above the closely packed swell of buildings, she swooped upward and allowed her wings to snap out to their full extent. The effort required to stop her fall was immense. For a moment it felt as if the wind might tear her wings free of their sockets. She shifted her tail to maintain balance, then wheeled over the city until she located the Black Shrike Thorn Cave, where the blood-mad priests worshipped. Tucking in her wings again, she dropped the last number of feet and with a thunderous crash landed on the middle of the cathedral's roof. She dug her claws into the tiles of the roof to stop herself from sliding off into the street below. Then she threw back her head and roared as loudly as she could, challenging the world and everything in it. There was a bell clanging in the tower of the building next to the Black Shrike Thorn Cave. She found the noise irritating, so she twisted her neck and loosed a jet of blue and yellow flame at it. The tower did not catch fire, as it was stone, but the rope and beams supporting the bell ignited, and a few seconds later, the bell fell crashing into the interior of the tower. That pleased her, as did the two legs round ears who ran screaming from the area. She was a dragon, after all. It was only right that they should fear her. One of the two legs paused by the edge of the square in front of the Black Shrike Thorn Cave, and she heard him shout a spell at her, his voice like the squeaking of a frightened mouse. Whatever the spell was, Aragorn's wards shielded her from it. At least she assumed they did, for she noticed no difference in how she felt, or in the appearance of the world around her. The wolf elf in Aragorn's shape killed the magician for her. She could feel how Blodgarm grasped hold of the spellcaster's mind and wrestled the two legs round his thoughts into submission, whereupon Blodgarm uttered a single word in the ancient elf magic language, and the two legs round ears fell to the ground, blood seeping from his open mouth. Then the wolf elf tapped her on the shoulder and said, "Ready yourself, Brightscales. Here they come." She saw Thorn rising above the edge of the rooftops, Aragorn half-brother Murtagh, a small dark figure on his back. In the light of the morning sun, Thorn shone and sparkled almost as brilliantly as she herself did. Her scales were cleaner than his, though, as she had taken special care when grooming earlier. She could not imagine going into battle looking anything but her best. Her enemies should not only fear her, but admire her. She knew it was vanity on her part, but she did not care. No other race could match the grandeur of the dragons. Also, she was the last female of her kind, and she wanted those who saw her to marvel at her appearance and to remember her well. So if dragons were to vanish forevermore, Two Legs would continue to speak of them with the proper respect, awe, and wonder. As Thorn climbed 1,000 or more feet above the rat nest city, Saphira spared a quick glance around to make sure that partner of her heart and mind, Aragorn, was nowhere near the black Shrikethorn cave. She did not want to hurt him by accident in the fight that was about to take place. He was a fierce hunter, but he was small and easily squished. She was still working to unravel the dark, echoing, painful memories Aragorn had shared with her. But she understood enough of them to know that events had once again proved what she had long believed. That whenever she and her partner of heart and mind were apart, he ended up in trouble of one form or another. Aragorn, she knew, would disagree, but his latest misadventure had done nothing to convince her otherwise, and she felt a perverse satisfaction in having been right. Once Thorn reached an appropriate height, he twisted round and dove toward her, flames shooting from his open maw. The fire she did not fear. Aragorn's wards would shield her from it. But Thorn's massive weight and strength would allow him to quickly exhaust any spells designed to shield her from physical danger. To protect herself, she ducked and pressed her body flat against the cathedral, even as she twisted her neck and snapped at Thorn's pale underbelly. A swirling wall of flames engulfed her, rumbling and roaring like a giant waterfall. The flames were so bright she instinctively closed her inner eyelids, the same as she would when underwater, and then the light was no longer blinding. The flames soon cleared, and as Thorn rushed past overhead, the tip of his thick, rib-bruising tail traced a line across the membrane of her right wing. The scratch bled, but not profusely, and she did not think it would cause her much difficulty while flying, painful though it was. Thorn dove at her again and again, trying to bait her into taking to the air. She refused to budge, however, and after a few more passes, he tired of harrying her and landed on the other side of the Black Shrikethorn cave, his huge wings outstretched for balance. The entire building shook as Thorn dropped to all fours, and many of the gem-glass picture windows in the walls below shattered and fell tinkling to the ground. Thorn was bigger than her now, as a result of the Eggbreaker Galbatorix's meddling, but she was not intimidated. She had more experience than Thorn, and besides, she had trained with Glaeda, who had been larger than both she and Thorn combined. Also, Thorn dared not kill her, nor did she think he wanted to. The red dragon snarled and stepped forward, the tips of his claws scraping against the tiles on the roof. She snarled in return and retreated several feet until she could feel her tail pressing against the base of the spires that rose up like a wall at the front of the Black Shrikethorn cave. The tip of Thorn's tail twitched, and she knew he was about to pounce. She drew in her breath and bathed him in a torrent of flickering flames. Her task now was to keep Thorn and Murtagh from realizing that it was not Aragorn who was sitting on her. To that end, she could either stay far enough away from Thorn that Murtagh would be unable to read the thoughts of the wolf-elf in Aragorn's shape, or she could attack often and ferociously enough that Murtagh would not have the opportunity, which would be difficult, as Murtagh was used to fighting from Thorn's back, even while Thorn turned and twisted through the air. Still, they were close to the ground, and that would help her, for she preferred to attack, always to attack. "Is that the best you can do?" Murtagh shouted with a magically enhanced voice from within the ever-shifting cocoon of fire. Even as the last of the flames died in her mouth, Saphira leaped toward Thorn. She struck him full in the chest, and their necks intertwined, heads slapping against one another as they each tried to fix their teeth around the other's throat. The force of the impact pushed Thorn backward off the Black Shrikethorn cave, and he flailed his wings, buffeting Sapphira as both he and she fell toward the ground. They landed with a crash that split paving stones and jarred the nearby houses. Something cracked in Thorn's left wing shoulder, and his back arched unnaturally as Murtag's wards kept the dragon from crushing him flat. Sapphira could hear Murtag cursing from underneath Thorn, and she decided that it would be best to move away before the angry two-legs round ears started casting spells. She jumped up, kicking Thorn in the belly as she did so, and alit on the peak of the house behind the red dragon. The building was too weak to support her, so she took flight again, and just for good measure, set the row of buildings on fire.
"Let them deal with that,"
she thought, satisfied, as the flames gnawed hungrily at the wooden structures. Returning to the Black Shrike Thorn Cave, she slipped her claws under the tiles and began to tear open the roof, ripping it apart, the same as she had ripped apart the roof of the castle in Durza Gilead. Only now she was bigger, now she was stronger, and the blocks of stone seemed to weigh no more than pebbles did to Aragorn. The blood-mad priests who worshipped within had hurt the partner of her heart and mind, had hurt dragon-blood Eltharia, young-face old-mind Angela, and the weercat Solombum, he of the many names. And they had killed Wyrden. For that, Sapphira was determined to destroy the Blackshrike Thorn Cave in revenge. Within seconds, she opened a gaping hole in the ceiling of the building. She filled the interior with a burst of flame, then hooked her claws into the ends of the brass pipes of the wind organ and pulled them free of the rear wall of the cathedral. They fell, clanging and crashing, onto the pews below. Thorn roared, and then he sprang up from the street into the air above the Blackshrike Thorn Cave and hung there, flapping heavily to maintain his position. He appeared as a featureless black silhouette against the wall of flames rising from the houses behind him, save for his translucent wings, which glowed orange and crimson. He lunged toward her, reaching out with serrated claws. Sapphira waited until the last possible moment, then she leaped off to the side, off the Blackshrike Thorn Cave, and Thorn rammed head first into the base of the cathedral's central spire. The tall, hole-ridden stone spike shuddered under the impact, and the very top of it, an ornate golden rod, toppled over and plunged more than 400 feet to the square below. Roaring with frustration, Thorn struggled to right himself. His hindquarters slid into the opening Sapphira had torn in the roof, and he scrabbled against the tiles as he tried to claw his way back out. While he did, Sapphira flew to the front of the Blackshrike Thorn Cave and positioned herself on the opposite side of the spire Thorn had collided with. She gathered her strength, then batted the spire with her right forepaw. Statues and carved decorations shattered underneath her foot. Clouds of dust clogged her nostrils, and bits of stone and mortar rained down upon the square. The spire held, though, so she struck it again. Thorn's bellowing took on a frantic note as he realized what she was doing, and he strove even harder to pull himself free. On Sapphira's third blow, the tall stone spike cracked at the base, and with agonizing slowness, collapsed backward, falling toward the roof. Thorn only had time to utter a furious snarl, and then the tower of rubble landed on top of him, knocking him down into the shell of the ruined building, and burying him under piles of rubble. The sound of the spire smashing to pieces echoed across the whole of the rat-nest city like a clap of rolling thunder. Sapphira snarled in response, this time with a sense of savage victory. Thorn would dig himself out soon enough, but until then he was at her mercy. Tilting her wings, she circled the Blackshrike Thorn Cave. As she passed along the sides of the building, she swung at the fluted buttresses that supported the walls, demolishing them one at a time. The blocks of stone tumbled to the ground, creating an unpleasant din. When she had removed all the buttresses, the unsupported walls began to sway and bulge outward. Thorn's efforts to extricate himself only worsened the situation, and after a few seconds, the walls gave way. The entire structure collapsed with an avalanche-like rumble, and a huge plume of dust billowed upward. Sapphira crowed with triumph. Then she landed on her hind legs next to the mound of debris and proceeded to paint the blocks of stone with the hottest stream of fire she could summon forth. Flames were easy to deflect with magic, but deflecting actual heat required greater effort and energy. By forcing Murtagh to expend even more of his strength to keep Thornin himself from being cooked alive, as well as whatever energy he was using to avoid being squished, she hoped to deplete his reserves enough that Aragorn and the Two-Legs Pointed Ears might have a chance of defeating him. While she breathed fire, the wolf elf on her back chanted spells. Though what they were for she did not know, nor did she particularly care. She trusted the Two-Legs. Whatever he was doing, she was sure it would help. Sapphira skittered backward as the blocks in the center of the mound exploded outward, and with a roar, Thorn lurched free of the rubble. His wings were crumpled, like those of a stepped-on butterfly, and he was bleeding from several gashes along his legs and back. He glared at her and snarled, his ruby eyes dark with battle rage. For the first time, she had truly angered him, and she could see that he was eager to tear at her flesh and taste her blood.
Good,
she thought. Maybe he was not quite such a beaten, frightened cur as she had assumed. Murtagh reached into a pouch on his belt and removed a small round object. From experience, Sapphira knew that it was enchanted, and he would use it to heal Thorn's injuries. Without waiting, she took flight, trying to gain as much altitude as possible, before Thorn was able to set off in pursuit. She glanced down after a few wingbeats and saw him rising toward her at a furious speed, a large red sharp-claw sparrowhawk. She twisted in the air and was just about to dive at him, when in the depths of her mind she heard Aragorn shout, "Sapphira!" Alarmed, she continued to twist until she was aimed at the southern arch gate of the city, where she had sensed Aragorn's presence. She pulled in her wings as close as she dared and dropped in a steep angle toward the arch. Thorn lunged at her as she plummeted past, and she knew without looking that he was following close behind. And so the two of them raced toward the thin wall of the Ratnest city, and the cool morning air off water howled like a wounded wolf in Sapphira's ears. Hammer and Helm.
At last, thought Roran, as the Varden's horns sounded the advance.
He glanced at Dras Leona and caught a glimpse of Sapphira diving toward the dark mass of buildings, her scales blazing in the light of the rising sun. Below, Thorn stirred like some great cat that had been sunning itself on a fence and took off in pursuit. A surge of energy coursed through Roran. The time for battle had finally arrived, and he was eager to be done with it. He spared a quick thought of concern for Aragorn, then pushed himself off the log where he was sitting and trotted over to join the rest of the men as they gathered in a wide rectangular formation. Roran glanced up and down the ranks, checking that the troops were ready. They had been waiting to fight for most of the night, and the men were tired, but he knew that fear and excitement would soon clear their minds. Roran was tired as well, but he paid it no mind. He could sleep when the battle was over. Until then, his main concern was keeping his men and himself alive. He did wish he had time for a cup of hot tea, though, to help settle his stomach. He had eaten something bad for dinner and had been racked with cramps and nausea ever since. Still, the discomfort was not enough to prevent him from fighting, or so he hoped. Satisfied with the state of his men, Roran pulled on his helm, pushing it down over his quilted arming cap. Then he drew his hammer and slipped his left arm through the straps on his shield.
"At your command," said Horst, walking up to him.
Roran nodded. He had chosen the smith as his second-in-command, a decision that Nasawada had accepted without dissent. Other than Aragorn, there was no one Roran would rather have by his side. It was selfish of him, he knew. Horst had a newborn child, and the Varden needed his metalworking skills. But Roran could not think of anyone else as well suited for the job.
Horst had not seemed especially pleased by the promotion, but neither had he seemed upset. Instead, he had gone about organizing Roran's battalion with the calm assurance and competency that Roran knew he possessed. The horns sounded again, and Roran lifted his hammer over his head.
"Forward!"
he shouted. He took the lead as the many hundreds of men started off, accompanied on either side by the Varden's four other battalions. As the warriors trotted across the open fields that separated them from Drasleona, cries of alarm rang out in the city. Bells and horns sounded a moment later, and soon the whole city was filled with an angry clamour as the defenders roused themselves. Adding to the commotion were the most terrible roars and crashes from the centre of the city, where the two dragons were fighting. Occasionally Roran saw one or another of them appear above the tops of the buildings, the dragon's hide bright and sparkling, but for the most part the two giants remained hidden from sight. The maze of ramshackle buildings that surrounded the city walls quickly drew near. The narrow, gloomy streets looked ominous and foreboding to Roran. It would be easy for the Empire's soldiers, or even the citizens of Drasleona, to ambush them within the twisting passageways. Fighting in such close quarters would be even more brutal, confusing, and messy than normal. If it came to that, Roran knew that few of his men would escape unscathed. As he moved into the shadows beneath the eaves of the first line of hovels, a hard knot of unease settled in Roran's gut, exacerbating his queasiness. He licked his lips, feeling sick.
"Aragorn had better open that gate," he thought. "If not, we'll be stuck out here like so many lambs penned up for slaughter."
And the walls fell. The sound of crashing masonry caused Aragorn to pause and look back. Between the peaks of two distant houses, he saw an empty space where the barbed spire of the cathedral used to be. In its place, a column of dust billowed toward the clouds above, like a pillar of white smoke. Aragorn smiled to himself, proud of Saphira. When it came to spreading chaos and destruction, dragons were without equal.
"Go on," he thought, "smash it to pieces. Bury their holy places under 1,000 feet of stone."
Then he resumed trotting down the dark, winding cobblestone street, along with Arya, Angela, and Solombum. There were a number of people already in the streets, merchants going to open their shops, night watchmen on their way to bed, drunk noblemen just emerging from their revels, vagrants sleeping in doorways, as well as soldiers running pell-mell toward the city walls. All of the people, even those who were running, kept looking in the direction of the cathedral as the noise of the two dragons fighting rumbled through the city. Everyone, from the sore-ridden beggars to the hardened soldiers to the richly dressed nobles, appeared terrified, and none of them gave Aragorn or his companions so much as a second glance. It helped, Aragorn supposed, that he and Arya could pass for ordinary humans on brief inspection. At Aragorn's insistence, Arya had deposited the unconscious novitiate in an alleyway a fair distance from the cathedral. "I promised we'd take him with us," Aragorn had explained, "but I never said how far. He can find his own way from here." Arya had acquiesced and seemed relieved to be rid of the novitiate's weight. As the four of them hurried down the street, a strange sense of familiarity came over Aragorn. His last visit to Drasleona had ended in much the same way, with him running between the dirty, close-set buildings, hoping to reach one of the city's gates before the Empire found him. Only this time he had more to fear than just the Razak. He glanced toward the cathedral again. All Saphira had to do was keep Murtagh and Thorn busy for another few minutes, and then it would be too late for either of them to stop the Varden. However, minutes could be like hours during a battle, and Aragorn was acutely aware of how fast the balance of power could change.
"Hold fast," he thought,
though he did not send his words to Saphira, lest he distract her or give away his position.
"Just a little longer."
The streets grew ever narrower as they approached the city wall, and the overhanging buildings, houses mostly, blocked out everything but a thin strip of the azure sky. Sewage lay stagnant in the gutters along the edges of the buildings. Aragorn and Arya used their sleeves to mask their noses and mouths. The stench seemed not to affect the herbalist, although Solemnbum growled and whipped his tail in annoyance. A flicker of movement on the roof of a nearby building caught Aragorn's attention, but whatever caused it had vanished by the time he looked. He continued to gaze upward, and after a few moments began to pick out certain odd sights. A patch of white against the soot-coated bricks of a chimney, strange pointed shapes outlined against the morning sky, a small oval spot the size of a coin that gleamed firelike in the shadows. With a shock, he realized that the rooftops were lined with dozens of weircats, all in their animal form. The weircats ran from building to building, watching silently from above, as Aragorn and his companions threaded their way through the dim maze of the city. Aragorn knew that the elusive shapeshifters would not deign to help, except in the most desperate of circumstances. They wished to keep their involvement with the Varden a secret from Galbatorix for as long as possible, but he found it heartening to have them so close. The street ended at an intersection of five other lanes. Aragorn consulted with Arya and the herbalist, then they decided to take the path opposite theirs and continue in the same direction. 100 feet ahead, the street they had chosen took a sharp turn and opened onto the square that lay before Drasleona's southern gate. Aragorn stopped. Hundreds of soldiers stood gathered before the gate. The men milled about in seeming confusion as they donned weapons and armor, and their commanders bellowed orders at them. The golden thread stitched into the soldiers' crimson tunics glittered as they rushed to and fro. The presence of the soldiers dismayed Aragorn, but he was even more dismayed to see that the city's defenders had piled a huge mound of rubble against the inside of the gates to keep the Varden from battering them in. Aragorn swore. The mound was so large it would take a team of 50 men several days to clear it away. Saphira could dig the gates free in a few minutes, but Murtagh and Thorn would never give her the opportunity. "We need another distraction," he thought. What that distraction should be, however, eluded him. "Saphira!" he cried, casting his thoughts out toward her. She heard him, of that he was sure, but he had no time to explain the situation to her, for at that very moment, one of the soldiers stopped and pointed at Aragorn and his companions. "Rebels!" Aragorn tore Brisinger from its scabbard and sprang forward before the rest of the soldiers could heed the man's warning. He had no other choice. To retreat would be to abandon the Varden to the mercies of the Empire. Besides, he could not leave Saphira to deal with both the wall and the soldiers by herself. He shouted as he leaped, as did Arya, who joined him in his mad charge. Together they cut their way into the midst of the surprised soldiers. For a few brief moments the men were so bewildered several did not seem to realize that Aragorn was their foe until he had stabbed them. Flights of arrows arced down into the square from the bowmen stationed on the parapet. A handful of the shafts bounced off Aragorn's wards, the rest killed or injured the Empire's own men. Fast as he was, Aragorn could not block all of the swords and spears and daggers poking at him. He could feel his strength ebbing at an alarming rate as his magic repelled the attacks. Unless he could win free of the press, the soldiers would end up exhausting him to the point where he could no longer fight. With a ferocious war cry, he spun in a circle, holding Brisinger close to his waist, as he scythed down all the soldiers standing within reach. The iridescent blue blade cut through bone and flesh as if they were equally insubstantial. Blood trailed from the tip in long, twisting ribbons that slowly separated into glistening drops like orbs of polished coral, while the men he cut doubled over, clutching at their bellies as they attempted to hold closed their wounds. Every detail seemed bright and hard-edged, as if sculpted from glass. Aragorn could make out individual hairs in the beard of the swordsman in front of him. He could count the drops of sweat that beaded the skin below the man's eyes, and he could have pointed to every stain, scuff, and tear in and on the swordsman's outfit. The noise of combat was painfully loud to his sensitive ears, but Aragorn felt a deep sense of calm. He was not immune to the fears that had troubled him before, but they did not waken quite so easily, and he fought better because of it. He completed his spin and was just moving toward the swordsman when Saphira swooped past overhead. Her wings were pulled tight against her body, and they fluttered like leaves in a gale, As she passed by, a blast of wind tousled Aragorn's hair and pressed him toward the ground. An instant later, Thorn followed Saphira, teeth bared, flames boiling in his open maw. The two dragons hurtled a half-mile beyond Dras Leona's yellow mud wall. Then they looped around and began to race back. From outside the walls, Aragorn heard a loud cheer. The Varden must be almost to the gates. A patch of skin on his left forearm burned as if someone had poured hot fat on it. He hissed and shook his arm, but the feeling persisted. Then he saw a blotch of blood soaking through his tunic. He glanced back at Saphira. It had to be dragon blood, but he could not tell whose. As the dragons approached, Aragorn took advantage of the soldiers' momentary daze to kill three more. Then the rest of the men regained their wits, and the battle resumed in earnest. A soldier with a battle axe stepped in front of Aragorn and started to swing at him. Halfway through the stroke, Arya dispatched the man with a slash from behind, nearly cutting him in twain. With a quick nod, Aragorn acknowledged her help. By unspoken agreement, they stood back to back and faced the soldiers together. He could feel Arya panting as hard as he was. Though they were stronger and faster than most humans, there was a limit to their endurance, a limit to their resources. They had already killed dozens, but hundreds remained, and Aragorn knew that reinforcements would soon arrive from elsewhere in Dras Leona. "What now?" he shouted, parrying a spear jabbed at his thigh. "Magic!" Arya replied. As Aragorn fended off the soldiers' attacks, he began to recite every spell he could think of that might kill their enemies. Another gust of wind ruffled his hair, and a cool shadow swept over him as Saphira circled above, dissipating her excess speed. She flared her wings and started to drop toward the battlements of the wall. Before she could land, Thorn caught up with her. The red dragon dove, breathing a jet of flame over 100 feet long. Saphira roared with frustration and veered away from the wall as she flapped quickly to gain altitude. The two dragons spiraled around each other as they climbed into the sky, biting and clawing with furious abandon. Seeing Saphira in danger only reinforced Aragorn's determination. He increased the speed with which he spoke, chanting the words of the ancient language as quickly as he could, without mispronunciation. But no matter what he tried, neither his spells nor Arya's had any effect on the soldiers. Then Murtagh's voice boomed out of the sky, like the voice of a cloud-scraping giant.
"Those men are under my protection, brother."
Aragorn looked up and saw Thorn plummeting toward the square. The red dragon's sudden change in direction had caught Saphira unawares. She still hung high above the city, a dark blue shape against the lighter blue of the sky. "They know," Aragorn thought, and dread punctured his earlier calm. He lowered his gaze and swept it over the throng. More and more soldiers were streaming out of the streets along either side of Dras Leona's wall. The herbalist was backed up against one of the bordering houses, throwing glass vials with one hand and swinging Tinkle Death with the other. The vials released clouds of green vapor when they broke, and any soldiers caught in the miasma fell to the ground, clutching their throats and thrashing as little brown mushrooms sprang up on every inch of exposed skin. Behind Angela, upon a flat-topped garden wall, crouched Solemn Bum. The weercat used his vantage point to claw at the soldiers' faces and pull off their helms, distracting them as they attempted to close with the herbalist. Both he and Angela looked beleaguered, and Aragorn doubted they would be able to hold out much longer. Nothing Aragorn saw gave him hope. He turned his eyes back toward the immense bulk of Thorn, even as the red dragon filled his wings with air and slowed his descent.
"We have to leave!" Arya shouted.
Aragorn hesitated. It would be a simple matter to lift Arya, Angela, Solembum, and himself over the wall to where the Varden would be waiting. But if they fled, the Varden would be no better off than before. Their army could not afford to wait any longer. After another few days, their supplies would run out, and the men would begin to desert. Once that happened, Aragorn knew they would never again succeed in uniting all the races against Galbatorix. Thorn's body and wings blotted out the sky, casting the area in ruddy darkness and hiding Saphira from view. Globules of blood, each the size of Aragorn's fist, dripped from Thorn's neck and legs, and more than one of the soldiers cried out in pain as the liquid scalded them.
"Aragorn, now!" shouted Arya.
She grabbed his arm and pulled, but still he held his ground, unwilling to admit defeat. Arya pulled harder, forcing Aragorn to look down in order to stay on his feet. As he did, his eye fell on the third finger of his right hand, where he wore Arryn. He had hoped to save the energy contained within the ring for the day when he might finally confront Galbatorix. It was a meager amount compared with what the king had undoubtedly accumulated during his long years on the throne, but it was the greatest store of power Aragorn possessed, and he knew he would not have the chance to gather its equal before the Varden reached Urabain, if indeed they did. Also, it was one of the few things Brom had left him. For both those reasons, he was reluctant to use any of the energy. Nevertheless, he could think of no alternative. The pool of energy within Arryn had always seemed enormous to Aragorn. Now he wondered if it would be enough for what he intended. At the edge of his vision, he saw Thorn reaching toward him with talons as large as a man, and some small part of him screamed to run away before the monster above caught him and ate him alive. Aragorn drew in his breath, then he breached Arryn's precious hoard and shouted, "Geirda!" The torrent of energy that flowed through him was greater than any he had ever experienced. It was like an ice-cold river that burned and tingled with almost unbearable intensity. The sensation was both agonizing and ecstatic. At his command, the huge pile of rubble blocking the gates erupted toward the sky in a solid pillar of earth and stone. The rubble struck Thorn in the side, shredding his wing and knocking the screeching dragon beyond the outskirts of Drasleona. Then the pillar spread outward, forming a loose canopy over the southern half of the city. The launch of the rubble shook the square and drove everyone to the ground. Aragorn landed on his hands and knees and remained there, staring upward as he maintained the spell. When the energy in the ring was almost depleted, he whispered, "Ganga Reta." Like a dark thunderhead caught in a gale, the plume drifted to the right, in the direction of the docks and Leona Lake. Aragorn continued to push the rubble away from the center of the city for as long as he could. Then as the last remnants of the energy coursed through him, he ended the spell. With a deceptively soft sound, the cloud of debris collapsed inward. The heavier elements, the stones, the broken pieces of wood, and the clumps of dirt, fell straight down, pummeling the surface of the lake, while the smaller particles remained suspended in the air, forming a large brown smudge that slowly drifted farther west. Where the rubble had been was now an empty crater. Broken paving stones edged the hollow like a circle of shattered teeth. The gates to the city hung open, warped and splintered, damaged beyond repair. Through the off-kilter gates, Aragorn saw the Varden massed in the streets beyond. He released his breath and allowed his head to fall forward in exhaustion. "It worked," he thought, dumbfounded. Then he slowly pushed himself upright, vaguely aware that the danger had not yet passed. While the soldiers struggled to their feet, the Varden poured into Drasleona, shouting war cries and banging their swords on their shields. A few seconds later, Saphira landed among them, and what had been about to turn into a pitched battle became a rout as the soldiers scrambled to save themselves. Aragorn glimpsed Rohan among the sea of men and dwarves, but lost sight of him before he could catch his cousin's attention.
"Arya?"
Aragorn turned and was alarmed to find that she was not next to him. He broadened his search and soon spotted her halfway across the square, surrounded by 20 or so soldiers. The men were holding her arms and legs with grim tenacity as they tried to drag her away. Arya freed one of her hands and struck a man in the chin, breaking his neck. But another soldier took his place before she could swing again. Aragorn sprinted toward her. In his exhaustion, he let his sword arm swing too low, and the tip of Brisinga caught on the mail hauberk of a fallen soldier, tearing the hilt from his grip. The sword clattered to the ground, and Aragorn hesitated, not sure if he should turn back. But then he saw two of the soldiers stabbing at Arya with daggers, and he redoubled his speed. Just as he reached her, Arya shook off her attackers for a moment. The men lunged with outstretched hands, but before they could recapture her, Aragorn struck one man in the side, driving his fist into the man's ribcage. A soldier with a pair of waxed mustachios stabbed at Aragorn's chest. Aragorn caught the blade with his bare hands, ripped it from the soldier's grip, broke the sword in two, and eviscerated the soldier with the stump of his own weapon. Within seconds, all the soldiers who had threatened Arya lay dead or dying. Those Aragorn had not killed, Arya slew. Afterward, Arya said, "I would have been able to defeat them on my own." Aragorn leaned over, resting his hands on his knees as he caught his breath.
"I know."
He nodded toward her right hand, the one she had injured pulling through the iron cuff, which she held curled against her leg.
"Consider it my thanks."
"A grim sort of present?"
But she said it with a faint smile on her lips. Most of the soldiers had fled the square. Those who remained were backed against the houses hemmed in by the Varden. Even as Aragorn looked about, he saw scores of Galbatorix's men throw down their weapons and surrender. Together, he and Arya retrieved his sword, and then they walked to the yellow mud wall, where the ground was relatively clear of filth. Sitting against the wall, they watched the Varden march into the city. Saphira soon joined them. She nuzzled Aragorn, who smiled and scratched her snout. She hummed in response.
"You did it,"
she said. "We did it," he replied. Up on her back, Blodgarm loosened the straps that held his legs in Saphira's saddle, then slid down her side. For a moment, Aragorn had the supremely disorienting experience of meeting himself. He immediately decided that he disliked how his hair curled at the temples. Blodgarm uttered an indistinct word in the ancient language. Then his shape shimmered like a heat reflection, and he was once again himself. Tall, furred, yellow-eyed, long-eared, and sharp-toothed. He appeared neither elf nor human, but in his tense, hard-set expression, Aragorn detected the stamp of sorrow and anger combined.
"Shadeslayer," he said,
and bowed to both Arya and Aragorn.
"Saphira has told me of Wirden's fate. I..."
Before he could finish his sentence, the 10 remaining elves under Blodgarm's command emerged from within the press of the Varden and hurried over, swords in hand.
"Shadeslayer," they exclaimed. "Arjut Lam, Bright Scales."
Aragorn greeted them tiredly and strove to answer their questions, even though he would rather have done nothing at all. Then a roar cut through their conversation and a shadow fell across them. And Aragorn looked up to see Thorn, whole and sound once more, balancing on a column of air high above. Aragorn cursed and scrambled onto Saphira, drawing Brisinga, while Arya, Blodgarm, and the other elves formed a protective circle around her. Their combined might was formidable, but whether it would be enough to fend off Murtagh, Aragorn did not know. As one, the Varden gazed upward. Brave they might be, but even the bravest might shrink before a dragon.
"Brother!"
shouted Murtagh, his augmented voice so loud that Aragorn covered his ears.
"I'll have blood from you for the injuries you caused, Thorn. Take Dras Leona if you want. It means nothing to Galbatorix. But you've not seen the last of us, Aragorn Shadeslayer. That I swear."
And then Thorn turned and flew north over Dras Leona, and soon vanished within the veil of smoke that rose from the houses burning next to the ruined cathedral. By the banks of Lake Leona, Aragorn strode through the darkened camp, his jaw set and his fists clenched. He had spent the last few hours in conference with Nasawada, Oryk, Arya, Garshvaag, King Orin, and their various advisers, discussing the day's events and assessing the Varden's current situation. Near the end of the meeting, they had contacted Queen Islanzadi to inform her that the Varden had captured Drasleona, as well as to tell her of Wirden's death. Aragorn had not enjoyed explaining to the Queen how one of her oldest and most powerful spellcasters had died, nor had the Queen been pleased to receive the news. Her initial reaction had been one of such sadness, it surprised him. He had not thought she knew Wirden that well. Talking with Islanzadi had left Aragorn in a foul mood, for it had reinforced for him how random and unnecessary Wirden's death had been. "If I had been in the lead, I would have been the one impaled on those spikes," he thought, as he continued his search throughout the camp. "Or it could have been Arya." Saphira knew what he was up to, but she had decided to return to the space by his tent where she normally slept, for as she said,
"If I go tromping up and down the rows of tents, I'll keep the Varden awake, and they have earned their rest."
Their minds remained joined, though, and he knew if he needed her, she would be at his side within seconds. To preserve his night vision, Aragorn avoided going near the bonfires and torches that burned before many of the tents, but he made sure to inspect each pool of light for his prey. As he hunted, it occurred to him that she might elude him entirely. His feelings for her were far from friendly, and that would allow her to sense his location and avoid him if she wanted. Yet he did not think she was a coward. Despite her youth, she was one of the hardest people he had met, human, elf, or dwarf. At last he spotted Elva, sitting in front of a small nondescript tent, weaving a cat's cradle by the light of a dying fire. Next to her sat the girl's caretaker, Greta, a pair of long wooden knitting needles darting in her gnarled hands. For a moment, Aragorn stood and watched. The old woman appeared more content than he had ever seen her, and he found himself reluctant to disturb her repose. Then Elva said,
"Do not lose your nerve now, Aragorn. Not when you have come so far."
Her voice was curiously subdued, as if she had been crying, but when she looked up, her gaze was fierce and challenging. Greta appeared startled when Aragorn made his way into the light. She gathered up her yarn and needles and bowed, saying,
"Greetings, Shadeslayer. May I offer you anything to eat or drink?"
"No, thank you." Aragorn stopped before Elva and stared down at the small-framed girl. She stared back at him for a moment, then returned to weaving the loop of yarn between her fingers. Her violet eyes, he noted with a strange twist in his stomach, were the same color as the amethyst crystals the priests of Helgrind had used to kill Wirden and imprison Arya and himself. Aragorn knelt and grabbed the tangle of yarn about the middle, stopping Elva's motion.
"I know what you intend to say," she stated.
"That may be," he growled, "but I'm still going to say it. You killed Wirden. You killed him as surely as if you had stabbed him yourself. If you had come with us, you could have warned him about the trap. You could have warned all of us. I watched Wirden die, and I watched Arya tear half her hand off because of you. Because of your anger, because of your stubbornness, because of your pride. Hate me if you will, but don't you dare make anyone else suffer for it. If you want the Varden to lose, then go join Galbatorix and be done with it. Well, is that what you want?"
Elva slowly shook her head. "Then I don't ever want to hear that you've refused to help Nasawada for no other reason than spite. Else there will be a reckoning between you and me, Elva Farseer. And it's not one you would win."
"You could never defeat me," she mumbled, her voice thick with emotion.
"You might be surprised. You have a valuable talent, Elva. The Varden needs your help now more than ever. I don't know how we're going to defeat the king at Urabane, but if you stand with us, if you turn your skill against him, we might just have a chance."
Elva seemed to struggle with herself. Then she nodded, and Aragorn saw that she was crying, tears overflowing from her eyes. He took no pleasure in her distress, but he felt a certain amount of satisfaction that his words had affected her so strongly.
I'm sorry, she whispered.
He released the yarn and stood. Your apologies cannot bring back Weirden. Do better in the future, and perhaps you can atone for your mistake. He nodded to the old woman, Greta, who had remained silent throughout their exchange, and then he strode out of the light and back between the dark rows of tents.
You did well, said Saphira. She will act differently from now on, I think.
I hope so. Upbraiding Elva had been an unusual experience for Aragorn. He remembered when Brom and Garrow had chastised him for making mistakes, and now to find himself the one doing the chastising left him feeling different, more mature. And so the wheel turns, he thought. He took his time walking through the camp, enjoying the cool breeze wafting off the lake, hidden within the shadows. After the capture of Dras Leona, Nasawada had surprised everyone by insisting that the Varden not stay the night in the city. She had given no explanation for her decision, but Aragorn suspected it was because the long delay at Dras Leona had left her over-eager to resume their journey to Urubane, and also because she had no desire to linger within the city, where any number of Galbatorix's agents might be lurking. Once the Varden had secured the streets, Nasawada detailed a number of warriors to remain in the city under the command of Martland Redbeard. Then the Varden had left Dras Leona and marched north, following the shore of the neighbouring lake. Along the way, a constant stream of messengers had ridden back and forth between the Varden and Dras Leona, as Martland and Nasawada conferred about the numerous issues attending the governance of the city. Before the Varden had departed, Aragorn, Saphira, and Blodgarm spellcasters had returned to the ruined cathedral, retrieved Weirden's body, and searched for the belt of Beloth the Wise. It had taken only a few minutes for Saphira to pull aside the jumble of stone that blocked the entrance to the underground chambers, and for Blodgarm and the other elves to fetch Weirden. But no matter how long they looked, and no matter what spells they used, they could not find the belt. The elves had carried Weirden on their shields out of the city, to a knoll next to a small creek. There they buried him, while singing several aching laments in the ancient language. Songs so sad that Aragorn had wept without restraint, and all the birds and animals within hearing had stopped and listened. The silver-haired elf woman Yela had knelt by the side of the grave, taken an acorn from the pouch on her belt, and planted it directly above Weirden's chest. And then the 12 elves, Arya included, sang to the acorn, which took root and sprouted, and grew twining upward, reaching and grasping toward the sky like a clutch of hands. When the elves had finished, the leafy oak stood 20 feet high, with long strings of green flowers at the end of every branch. Aragorn had thought it was the nicest burial he had ever attended. He much preferred it to the dwarves' practice of entombing their dead in hard, cold stone deep below the ground, and he liked the idea of one's body providing food for a tree that might live for hundreds of years more. If he had to die, he decided that he would want an apple tree planted over him, so that his friends and family could eat the fruit born of his body. The concept had amused him tremendously, albeit in a rather morbid manner. Besides searching the cathedral and retrieving Weirden's body, Aragorn had also done one other thing of note in Dras Leona after its capture. He had, with Nasawada's approval, declared every slave within the city a free person, and he had personally gone to the manors and auction houses and cut loose many of the men, women, and children chained therein. The act had given him a great deal of satisfaction, and he hoped it would improve the lives of the people he had released. As he drew near his tent, he saw Arya waiting for him by the entrance. Aragorn quickened his stride, but before he could greet her, someone called out, "Shadeslayer!" Aragorn turned and saw one of Nasawada's pages trotting toward them. "Shadeslayer!" the boy repeated, somewhat out of breath, and bowed to Arya. "Lady Nasawada would like you to come to her tent an hour before dawn tomorrow morning, in order to confer with her. What shall I tell her, Lady Arya?" "You may tell her I will be there when she wishes," Arya replied, inclining her head slightly. The page bowed again, and then he spun around and ran off in the direction from which he had come.
"It's somewhat confusing now that we've both killed a shade,"
Aragorn observed with a faint grin. Arya smiled as well, the motion of her lips almost invisible in the darkness.
"Would you rather I had let Varag live?"
"No, not at all.
I could have kept him as a slave, to do my bidding."
"Now you're teasing me," he said. She made a soft sound of amusement.
"Perhaps I should call you Princess instead. Princess Arya."
He said it again, enjoying the feel of the words in his mouth.
"You should not call me that," she said more serious. "I am not a princess."
"Why not? Your mother is a queen. How can you not be a princess? Her title is Drottning. Yours is Drottningu. One means queen, and the other..."
"Does not mean princess," she said. "Not exactly. There is no true equivalent in this language."
"But if your mother were to die or step down from her throne, you would take her place as ruler of your people, wouldn't you?"
"It is not that simple."
Arya did not seem inclined to explain further, so Aragorn said,
"Would you like to go in?"
"I would," she said.
Aragorn pulled open the entrance to his tent, and Arya ducked inside. After a quick glance at Saphira, who lay curled up nearby, breathing heavily as she drifted off to sleep, Aragorn followed. He went to the lantern that hung from the pole in the center of the tent and murmured,
"Istari,"
not using Brisinger so as to avoid igniting his sword. The resulting flame filled the interior with a warm, steady light that made the sparsely furnished army tent seem almost cozy. They sat, and Arya said,
"I found this among Wirden's belongings, and I thought we might enjoy it together."
From the side pocket of her pants, she produced a carved wooden flask about the size of Aragorn's hand. She handed it to him. Aragorn unstoppered the flask and sniffed at the mouth. He raised his eyebrows as he smelled the strong, sweet scent of liqueur.
"Is it Feilnerf?" he asked,
naming the drink the elves made from elderberries and, Nari had claimed, moonbeams. Arya laughed, and her voice rang like well-tempered steel.
"It is, but Wirden added something else to it."
"Oh?"
"The leaves of a plant that grows in the eastern part of Duweldenvarden, along the shores of Rona Lake."
He frowned.
"Do I know the name of this plant?" "Probably, but it's of no importance. Go on, drink. You'll like it, I promise."
And she laughed again, which gave him pause. He had never seen her like this before. She seemed fey and reckless, and with a jolt of surprise, he realized she was already rather tipsy. Aragorn hesitated, and he wondered if Gleda was watching them. Then he lifted the flask to his lips and swallowed a mouthful of the Feilnerf. The liqueur tasted different than he was accustomed to. It had a potent, musky flavor, similar to the scent of a martin or a stoat. Aragorn grimaced and fought the urge to gag as the Feilnerf burned a track down his throat. He took another, smaller sip, and then passed the flask back to Arya, who drank as well. The past day had been one of blood and horror. He had spent most of it fighting, killing, almost being killed himself, and he needed a release. He needed to forget. The tension he felt was too deep-seated to ease with mental tricks alone. Something else was required, something that came from outside of himself, even as the violence he had participated in had for the most part been external, not internal. When Arya returned the flask to him, he downed a large quaff, and then chuckled, unable to help himself. Arya raised an eyebrow and regarded him with a thoughtful, if merry, expression.
"What amuses you so?"
"This. Us. The fact that we're still alive and they..." He waved his hand in the direction of Dras Leona. "Aren't. Life amuses me. Life and death." A warm glow had already begun to form in his belly, and the tips of his ears had started to tingle.
"It is nice to be alive," said Arya.
They continued to pass the flask back and forth until it was empty, at which point Aragorn fit the stopper back into the mouth of the container, a task that required several attempts, for his fingers felt thick and clumsy, and the cot seemed to tilt underneath him, like the deck of a ship at sea. He gave the empty flask to Arya, and as she took it, he grasped her hand, her right hand, and turned it toward the light. The skin was once more smooth and unblemished. No sign of her injury remained. "Blodgarm healed you?" said Aragorn. Arya nodded, and he released her.
"Mostly. I have full use of my hand again."
She demonstrated by opening and closing it several times.
"But there is still a patch of skin by the base of my thumb, where I have no feeling."
She pointed with her left index finger. Aragorn reached out and lightly touched the area. "Here?"
"Here,"
she said, and moved his hand a bit to the right.
"And Blodgarm wasn't able to do anything about it?"
She shook her head.
"He tried half a dozen spells, but the nerves refused to join."
She made a dismissive motion.
"It's of no consequence. I can still wield a sword, and I can still draw a bow. That is all that matters."
Aragorn hesitated, then said, "You know how grateful I am for what you did, what you tried to do. I am only sorry it left you with a permanent mark. If I could have prevented it somehow..."
"Do not feel bad because of it. It's impossible to go through life unscathed, nor should you want to. By the hurts we accumulate, we measure both our follies and our accomplishments. Angela said something similar about enemies, that if you didn't make them, you were a coward or worse."
Arya nodded.
"There is some truth to that."
They continued to talk and laugh as the night wore on. Instead of weakening, the effects of the altered fail nerve continued to strengthen. A giddy haze settled over Aragorn, and he noticed that the pockets of shadow in the tent looked as if they were swirling, and strange, flashing lights, like those he normally saw when he closed his eyes at night, floated across his field of vision. The tips of his ears were burning fever-hot, and the skin on his back itched and crawled, as if ants were marching over it. Also, certain sounds had acquired a peculiar intensity. The rhythmic chirping of the lakeside insects, for example, and the crackle of the torch outside his tent. They dominated his hearing to the point where he had difficulty singling out any other noise.
"Have I been poisoned?"
he wondered.
"What is it?"
asked Arya, noticing his alarm. He wet his mouth, which had become incredibly painfully dry, and told her what he was experiencing. Arya laughed and leaned back, her eyes heavy and half-lidded.
"That is as it should be. The sensations will wear off by dawn. Until then, relax and allow yourself to enjoy them."
Aragorn struggled with himself for a moment as he debated whether to use a spell to clear his mind, if indeed he could. But then he decided to trust Arya and follow her advice. As the world bent around him, it occurred to Aragorn how dependent he was on his senses to determine what was real and what was not. He would have sworn that the flashing lights were there, though the rational part of his mind knew they were only fail-nerve-induced apparitions. He and Arya continued to talk, but their conversation became increasingly disjointed and incoherent. Nevertheless, Aragorn was convinced that everything they said was of paramount importance, although he could not have explained why. Nor could he remember what they had discussed only moments before. Sometime later, Aragorn heard the low, throaty sound of a reed pipe being played somewhere in the camp. At first he thought he was imagining the lilting tones, but then he saw Arya cock her head and turn in the direction of the music, as if she too had noticed it. Who was playing and why, Aragorn could not tell, nor did he care. It was as if the melody had sprung out of the blackness of the night itself, like a wind